So Mari wanted me to talk about a more ambitious goal, that is the prediction of influenza. So the title is a little bit more modest, but what we'll see probably at the end, what we can say about prediction of this system. Is there any chance of a pointer or something, or some stick? Great, thank you. So, yeah, I should mention, as Natalia already mentioned, this is joint work with Natalia Strakova, who was a diploma student in my group, and now she's at Imperial College. So, let me just give you a very brief introduction to influenza, which is, of course, has made not only headlines in scientific papers, but also in daily papers, since the threat of a new pandemic of avian influenza. So it is a major system of health concern. It's one of the main viral infections that kill of the order of 500,000 per year, and that this is why to the medical community it is a very serious system, and hence it's also very well observed. So since the end of the 60s, the WHO has rather systematic records of influenza, and that is part of the reason why it's also a very interesting system for evolutionary biology and why we're talking about it today. It is a rather unique system where a strongly selected case of evolution has been observed under natural conditions over a sufficient period of time. And we're going to see what sufficient period of time means. So the observations are at different levels, and that's also what makes the system interesting. On the one hand, the viral genome, which is a very compact genome of just over 10,000 base pairs, it is known now for several thousand strains since that have been collected for the last 40 years. And the genome consists of several segments that recombine between each other, but the sequence is rather intact within each segment. So the main focus and the main wealth of sequence information comes from one surface protein, which is the viral hemagglutinin, and that is the system which is one of the parts of this viral genome that is of particular interest, because it directly interacts with the human antibodies. So here is this viral protein, and it has a sub domain which is called the epitope, and it's a sort of collection of sites, and one roughly knows which segments of the codons of the sequence correspond to this binding domain. And so it has here in particular a subdomain which is the receptor binding site, and that subdomain interacts with the antigen binding fragment of the human antibody. So this is the main locus where the race with the human immune system takes place. So we should already expect that this part of the genome has a particular signature of selection, and we're going to see this in some detail. So there is a wealth of genomic information, and there is also some functional information, namely which sites are forming this epitope. This is not a sort of black and white picture. There are certainly some sites that mainly contribute to these binding properties and others less, but there is a collection of sites that is known to contribute to this binding of genomic sites. So we're talking about a rather limited sequence space here. This is of the order of 60 codons that contribute to this binding pocket, and where we, of course, then expect the selection to be mostly concentrated on. So there is some structural information and some information on the functional properties of this protein, and there is also what you could call phenotypic data. So the WHO has also collected interaction data, hemagglutinin inhibition tests that just measure how strongly a given serum that is made against one strain interacts with other strains. So here, this part of this information is collected. This was a collection that has been compiled in a previous publication. So you see here, this is again time ordered roughly. There's about 80 sera over these 40 years. You start here from early years until today, and there's about 270 strains, and you can see, and the color coding indicates how strong this interaction is. So you could see this as a rough representation. If you think that one serum is mainly made against one strain, as a rough representation of strain interaction, and as another way of quantifying the evolution, which is on a slightly higher level than the genomic level. So the particularity, I've mentioned it already, is that this system, we have time series of the evolution. I will see this time series covers both micro and macro evolution, in a sense to be made precise in a moment. And this time series is on an adaptive process in a changing environment. A changing environment is obviously given by the continuously changing immune challenge. And that makes the system rather unique.
How do they order the strains?
Well, in this case, we have ordered these strains in a way that clusters this as well as possible. But the point is, you don't need to do a lot of work to cluster them, because roughly the time ordering, you can think roughly as this axis, as time axis.
So you say you ordered them to cluster the data, but does this ordering correlate with the time ordering?
Right, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. So this clustering is not something that where you need to be very fancy. Even if you just order these strains by time, you get a picture that roughly looks like this, and then you can locally make it look a bit nicer.
The fact that some of these are quite broad, some narrow before you get these shifts.
Right. That is not, doesn't mean very much, because in the early years you simply have less strains collected. But what you do see is that at the antigenic level, and we're going to see this in a moment a bit more, the evolution is somewhat more punctuated. So you see often what is an intrinsic information that is independent of how many strains you collect is that you go to a certain year, you look, have some strong reaction with some sera, and then this reaction suddenly stops for the other strains and it reacts with other sera. So in this antigenic space, and this is known from a number of previous studies, the evolution is a bit more rugged, a bit more punctuated than on the genomic level, although, and you see this already here, and we're going to see this in a moment, it's again not a black and white picture of strong clusters, but somewhat blurred. So, from what I've just said, you could conclude that this is an evolutionary biologist's dream system. However, this dream can somewhat also turn into a nightmare, because if you think a little bit about this, then the system is not like many others. In our working with the system, sort of just about any expectation that we initially had proved wrong. So, and there's reasons why the system is sufficiently different to fool our intuition at times. And I would call it, it's quite generically a strong coupling system. And what I mean by this is that it has several features that deviate strongly from our experience, shaped roughly by neutral evolution and maybe perturbations of neutral evolution. So first of all, there is, and we'll see this in a moment in more detail, there is strong linkage, genomic linkage. And this, of course, means that sites are coupled in their evolution and are just far from independence. And we're going to see in a moment rather explicitly the consequences of that. So when you see a site suddenly some allele rapidly moving, it's really not clear. Is this its own selection? Is it hitchhiking? Or what is it doing? So we need to really think how to disentangle linkage effects from the primary action of selection. So this is true within this particular binding domain. Of course, there is frequent reassortment between different segments of the viral genome, and this is in fact believed to be one of the main factors of danger of a new pandemic, because the system could import another genomic segment from an avian strain and then reassort it with human strains, and that is believed to be one of these sort of virulence generating factors for this system. So, secondly, we'll also see this in more detail, but already from the outset, if we know nothing about this system, we should expect selection to be strong, and we should also expect it to be reasonably complex, because it is shaped by this race with the immune system. And of course, these conditions that the immune system imposes on the system are themselves changing over time, and they're changing roughly at the same speed as the response of the system. So we should also expect already that a very simple population genetic model where we just put selection coefficients on different sites is not representing the full truth of this selection. It's probably not representing the full truth in any system, but in this system, it's sort of since selection is so strong, it is particularly apparent. We can actually infer some of this time dependence from the genomic data. And finally, the system has an outrageously high mutation rate, as we'll also see. And so you could think, well, what does this do except making things faster and just shrink time intervals? So obviously, it does shrink time intervals considerably. The time span that we see over these 40 years consists roughly to a time span of 20 million years for Drosophila evolution. So we're talking about macroevolution here. So it does certainly accelerate things, but it does not only accelerate things, and we're going to argue that it qualitatively changes the pattern of evolution, and by this we mean basically the pattern of clonal interference that comes from this linkage. So this is what we're going to see in some detail. So in some sense, when you take these effects together, they are all far away from independent neutral sites. So we had a discussion a week ago here on of open questions posed by this workshop, and in some sense you can see this talk as a corollary to that discussion, because pretty much all the questions that we covered so far in this discussion can be asked for this system, and maybe can be partially, and well, the system can maybe give some clues how to answer them. So we were talking about how to deal with selection in a context of strongly linked sites. So in this system, we'll see very strong selection under and strong linkage effect, and see how they conspire to form this pattern of evolution. How would we talk about effective population size? What remains of this concept of effective population size in this strongly linked context? So you will see that in this talk there are many numbers, but the one number that does not appear is an effective population size. And I don't even know for this system what the meaning of it would be, because the system is so far away from any sort of diffusion-controlled behavior, except maybe for very low allele frequencies that are not covered by this observation of this data. So we're going to see this. So certainly, the concept of a diffusivity of an effective population size is very much questionable for this system, but also the kind of question that Ville Mustonen has asked in his talk. So how much does remain of our concept of very simple selection, just given by a selection coefficient? We'll see that in this system, you can also quite explicitly see that selection is more complex and should be addressed by different models. So to make this long introduction short, so the question that we want to ask is, in all this nightmare, what remains of our power to identify natural selection? And of course, selection is among all these stochasticities, is the only deterministic effect. So this is a more modest way to pose the question, can we, at least for some limited time, predict its evolution? So how much is there determinism in all this stochastic mess? So let me first try to reconstruct what we know about mainly the genomic evolution of this hemagglutinin binding domain fragment over the last 40 years. So first we want to reconstruct the evolution, then we want to infer properties. And to some extent, we can extend this analysis to this phenotype of hemagglutinin inhibition tests. So that means to directly address the interaction with the human host and its evolution. So here is what you get if you feed about 2,000 strains collected from these 40 years into a tree building tool like PAUP in this case. So standard tool works reasonably well here. In fact, this distance, I'm afraid these yearly numbers are not very well readable. This starts here with 93 and this is 0 and this is 03, 96, 98 and so on. And subsequent years are color-coded in different colors. And so this is showing only the last 13 years of this 40-year period. The previous years look pretty much the same, except that there are less strains because the data gets scarcer the further we go into the past. So the first thing that you see is that the overall picture of this tree as a function of time doesn't look too weird. So the in this algorithm by this tool, the observed strains will appear always as external nodes here at the end of these branches. And so the color coding is by these subsequent years. And the horizontal axis that is plotted here is just the mutational distance from the root of the tree. So it starts here from 140 because the root of the tree is in 1968 and goes up to 200. So here we span roughly 60 mutations over this horizontal axis over these 13 years. And I say mutational distance is not quite identical to the Hamming distance because in the system there are so many mutations that occasionally they're already over this time span of 40 years. There are double mutations at one locus. And so the Hamming distance would be somewhat already reduced with respect to this distance that you get when you follow up every mutation event along a lineage from a strain to the ancestor. So the strains are roughly ordered in time. So we can say there is an approximate molecular clock of about 4 substitutions per year in this domain. That feature, you think of the term molecular clock, you could maybe be thinking of neutral evolution or something near neutral. But of course, if you take a second look on this tree, you see that it's really far from neutral. And you see this already when you just look at the tree. Because there are plenty of coalescent branchings over short periods of time. In our sample, there is sufficient resolution that we see plenty of branchings over a short period of time, but this tree is always pruned by selection to follow sort of a very narrow path along the sort of this one successful lineage that connects future and the past that people call the trunk of the tree. So the sequence diversity remains very limited. There are no lineages other than the trunk that survive for more than 2 or 3 years. So the average coalescent time, if you take all the strains from 1 year and ask how many years do you go back before they all collapse to a common ancestor, is of the order of 3.5 years, and it's never more than of the order of 5 years. So you would expect that if the system were near neutral, you would occasionally see much longer side branches of the tree. So we were talking about how much survives of the coalescent under selection. So here you have an example where we also can discuss that question. It is a coalescent under strong selection, and we can see what remains of the structure of this coalescent. So I should say, I wanted to say one more thing, but now I've lost it.
So looking at the, you know, this can't help being amazed. So if two things never survive, how come one thing survives always?
This is a good question, because you could, if you think of a branching process with a certain branching rate, and a certain annihilation rate, you would conclude that there is either the system has to expand or the system has to go extinct. So that will be the phase transition expected, and this is exactly remains sort of at this one-dimensional borderline. So the so this must be a property, or I would guess this is exactly a property of that selection, but it's not yet fully understood. So what it means, of course, is that the strains compete with each other. So they have a common pool of sort of human repertoire, and hence the success of one strain is the death of the other strain. So far so good. What is not terribly well understood, and this Luca Pelitti has discussed it in his colloquium talk a few weeks ago, is why exactly is there this competition? Because If none of these strains really infects all humans, so if one of them infects 2% of the human population, why is there this strong sort of common pool that limits the overall population size and not just partial population sizes? And this is, in various models, of course, you can build this in. It's very easy to make a common sort of chemical potential for the overall population size, but justifying it from the ecology of the system is another story and an unsolved point.
But isn't it so that the influenza has a cycle where it's in humans part of the time and then in other animals, reservoirs part of the time?
It's like as safe as possible. And don't worry,
sorry, this is suddenly the BBC has turned itself on. Sorry about that. So,
and how do you really know that this selection is going on in the human population and not in pigs or in chickens?
No, this system does only very occasional. There is occasional exchange, but this is what causes these pandemics. So these strains are circulating in the human population, and people make geographical models of this. So one of the models is that it's sort of in the winter, it's seasonal and goes to the northern hemisphere. Of course, most of the population is every winter, and then the rest, it's sort of, if the population size has shrunk in summer, it sort of survive in the tropics. But these are strains entirely circulating in the human population. Now, what you occasionally read in newspapers when there is a bird flu outbreak, say in Southeast Asia, this is in fact an avian strain that is now in a human host, but these strains are not yet transmissible between humans. So they need an extra mutation to become transmissible between humans. That's why so far these outbreaks have always been limited, and local measures of prevention, like closing schools and so on, are taken to prevent the further outbreak. The fear of the community is that the virus will learn how to be this modified virus will learn how to be transmissible between humans, and then you would have a rapid outbreak of a pandemia. And it's believed that at least one of the two pandemias of the last century was exactly caused by this sort of importing of avian material and recombining it with human strains. And people have sort of suspicion, like, what are the dangerous mutations and where they could be located to make this last step to the blow up and the human population. But these are exclusively, this is the seasonal virus that is exclusively circulating in the human population. So just one aside, which is not really the focus today, but you can of course also map these antigenic data on a tree do a phylogenetic reconstruction of those, and then you see that what we saw before already, like that the evolution on the antigenic level is somewhat more punctuated, but you can see, so this is again, so from this is strain overlaps in this antigenic feature vector, if you will, and I'll not go into the technology that we used here. You see this is again the time axis from 1968 till 2006, and you can see that it's roughly concentrated along the diagonal, and a cluster remains something more coherent of a time over a few years, but it's also, so this can be compared with previous approaches that did a sort of straightforward clustering without the phylogeny, and you can see that there is something of that structure, but you can also see that it's not a black and white picture. Whether you want to have five clusters or 11 clusters, this is to your taste, like in any clustering approach. So this is the history over the last 40 years. And before we go into selection, let's look at what was already advertised as sort of strongly influencing the system, namely the effects of genomic linkage, and connected with that the effects of high mutation rate. And these two things, they are not separable in this system, and we'll see in which way they are interlinked. So this is just a reminder, which is of course boring to the people who have been here for a long, long time, because this was in some sense the general theme of this, or one of the main theme of this workshop, understanding the statistics behind this kind of system. So what do we mean by linkage effects, and what, so in a small population, so we're talking about a population that which has little recombination. And we heard that asexual populations are some approximation to this, although there are also asexuals which do a lot of sort of reassortment, in which case they are not such a good approximation. So here we think of a population where genomic linkage is strong. Now, if the population size and the mutation rate are small enough, then you have occasional fixations of beneficial mutations, but they are rare, and since they are rare, they are well separated in time, and that means that their separation, which is sort of proportional to the time between two subsequent events, which is proportional sort of to the beneficial mutation rate multiplied by the population size, is small against the fixation time of any one of them. So that would be the simple case. And then clonal interference describes the breakdown of this independence as soon as the population size and the mutation rate become larger. And this is the famous picture, which says that in this case, more there is a competition between clones, and this competition between these linked beneficial mutation leads to the fact that at any one overlapping time, only one of them can win. So these two clones will die out. They could form in a sexual population. They could recombine, and then B would not be lost because C has to win, but here C wins. Of course, this is again, and then once one of these beneficial mutations has been fixed, then sort of the game starts afresh. This picture, which I copied from one of the papers, says, of course, in some sense only half of the truth, because it could also be that this new beneficial mutation happens to be inside B, then B is carried along by hitchhiking, and so a lot of stuff is also fixed faster than it would be on its own if it's on the sort of right bandwagon. So what do we learn from this for the genomic inference of this, which is of course our focus here in this data set? So the signature of clonal interference is that the temporal ordering of origination and fixation events is exactly the same. So if you look here, for the mutations that get fixed, for that subset, here that will be C, and then the next one is F. We can talk about the ordering of their origination events, so that will be this time and this time, and we can talk about the order of their fixation events, so that will be this time and this time, and these two orderings are exactly the same. That's what we should look for if we have time series. And the second effect comes from the ones that are not depicted here. So if C were in the subset, in the allele subset B, then B would be pushed along together with C by hitchhiking. So B and C would fix at a very similar time. So the second thing that we could look for is clustering of fixation times. So this is what you get in influenza. So this is again this time span between 1970 and 2005. And here, this is a dot plot, which just for each of these fixed mutations takes the entry year and the fixation year. And you can see that, I've color-coded the mutations here in three classes. They are the synonymous mutations in this HI1 domain. The red ones are the non-synonymous mutations outside this binding subdomain, outside the epitope, and the green ones are the ones that are in the epitope. So this is the color coding throughout in the subsequent transparency. So green is the ones that are under putative positive selection, red are the ones that are under putative negative selection, and blue are the putatively near neutral ones. So, and you can see, so the first thing you can see is that there is indeed a staircase pattern, which is here, this line here, that covers most of these dots. And that's exactly that temporal ordering. So if we had a perfect pattern of clonal interference, I'll talk about in a minute what the deviation from this pattern is, then all the points should be off this staircase, on this staircase. And the second, the temporal ordering is satisfied by the majority of these changes. If you count it, then it's of the order of 70 to 80% of these changes that satisfy this temporal ordering. The deviations from this are very interesting. I'll talk about it in a minute. Yes?
So what's the definition of a fixation here?
So the fixation is a point in time when, so an origination is when a new allele enters the population. More precisely, it enters our data set, so that there is, if one of the strains, one of the sequences has that mutation. In most cases, that origination event will be an inferred event somewhere up in the phylogeny, because we have observation. And then, so the reconstruction of this tree, should have mentioned that before, of course, maps the mutations on branches of the tree. So there's a mutation generating a new allele. Then at that point, we say there's an origination of that allele. And then the fixation is if that allele is in the entire population. So if all the ancestorial allele at this locus has died out.
So your data set is sampling at now or something in different years?
Sorry,
You have lots of samples.
Yes.
Of the leaf virus. You sample it at different times, let's say 1990s, 2000.
Yeah.
Or you sample it just in one year.
Yeah, well, so the samples come from different years. So you would observe, for example, one allele for the first time in a couple of strains in 1990. Maybe your tree reconstruction tells you that it must have or should have appeared already somewhere in 1989 or something. And then if this is a successful allele, maybe in 1993 or so, everybody has this allele. All the subsequent strains have that allele. Then you would mark this entry year, the first origination of this allele is 1989, and 1993 would be the fixation year. So that's what is plotted here.
If the samples come from different samples from different years, have you taken into account, please, in the collection tree building? I mean, in the standard collection theory and the collection tools, we suppose that all the samples are sampled now and trace back the most recent common ancestor.
Well, you see, I mean, the basic tree building just takes mutational, just takes the sequences. But as it turns out, it also orders the strain reasonably per year. There also, you could try to use a more sophisticated tool that actually builds the timing into the tree reconstruction. People have done that, but it gives similar trees. So that will be more important if you are if you're really interested in the fine timing of sequences, as you would do if you talk about things like how things expand within one winter season. And if you do sort of migration studies of this virus over regions. So here, for the sectioning year by year, it works perfectly fine. So you're right. We have not built in the time information into the tree reconstruction, but as I've shown you, the overall timing of this coalescence just comes out, which is, of course, a consequence of the fact that the genetic distance is relatively linearly increasing with time. And this fact, in turn, is also not so surprising if we think a clonal interference process, because that imposes some kind of temporal regularity on this mutational pattern. So, and you can also see that fixation events are clustered. So I've marked here the 10 most pronounced clusters. So there are some years that really collect most of these fixations. So as I said, so 10 years out of 40 years is only a quarter of the years, but a quarter of the years accounts for about 70 to 80% of the substitution. So there is some kind of clustering of the fixation events that is not observed at the level of the origination events. So they are a bit more punctuated. And some of these clusters are well correlated with what we saw also at the antigenic level at this. So that would be the boundaries between these clusters that we have seen in this clustering picture before. So this tells you that clonal interference is a strong force in this picture. I should emphasize, of course, that there could be other reasons why fixation events are clusters. You could think of strong epistasis that a single of these green mutations that change something in the epitope is not strong enough to make it, and only a collection of two or three would then be pushed. And in fact, this was one of the standard models for the system, that epistasis is something very strong in this system. But that conclusion doesn't really hold, because you can see that the same clustering affects also the putative near-neutral mutations, the synonymous changes. So if sites were approximately independent and there were mainly epistasis generating that, we should expect to see a stronger clustering for the green ones with respect to the blue ones. But in fact, this percentage is the same for all three classes, the red ones, the blue ones, and the green ones. There are less red dots because there are less fixations outside the epitope, which points towards negative selection, but the fraction of the changes that are covered in these classes is the same in all three classes, and that points towards strong hitchhiking effects as the main cause causing this clustering. And you can see what is consistent with that is that the sequence diversity has drops in that are correlated in time with these fixation clusters. Sometimes the drop in diversity is a year before the fixation cluster, because the fixation cluster is marked when every other strain has died out, but the diversity is down when most other strains have died out. So it is always in the year, or like here, it's a year before the cluster, this dip in diversity.
If it's a bit devil's advocate, two things, because supposing you just have a neutral, like a neutral Rat Fisher model with a small population size,
right,
and you simulate that forest for a long time, and you keep all the ones which died out, and then you construct a tree. It's going to look pretty much like your tree with a trunk and short branches, because you know that there's only one trunk in a thing like that, because you know that after n generations you've coalesced to a common ancestor, even in the neutral model, right? And normally we don't have that information going back in the past. I mean, so you're in an unusual situation of having those sequences from far back. But even a neutral model would give you that trunk tree, and it seems to me even a neutral model with many linked sites would give you clusters of fixations as well, because basically there's one trunk, and every time the last common ancestor changes, you get a cluster of linked fixations, right?
Well, I mean, I'm happy with that at the moment. Here we want to prove linkage. So as long as you are willing to accept, we'll come to selection in some detail a couple of slides later. As long as you accept that these clustering of fixation events that is in all three mutation classes, the synonymous and the non-synonymous and the two classes of non-synonymous ones, points against independent sites, then we're fine on this slide. So the claim is, if you were to plot this for independent sites, you would basically you would have lots of violations of this temporal ordering. So you would fill in basically. So here, of course, the entry year and the fixation year has to be always after the entry year. So if you have here a diagonal, all the points have to be below. But then you would just fill the distance from this diagonal with some Poisson process, and there would be no staircase whatsoever. That's what you would expect for independent sites. Now, there is this staircase here, which covers sort of a significant fraction of the changes. And then you can ask, is it more like epistasis that selection groups these fixations together, that it's synergistic epistasis, that maybe triplets have a higher chance to get fixed? And then I would argue, well, that would be a good explanation for the green guys, but it wouldn't without linkage, it wouldn't explain the clustering of the blue guys, which is nearly as strong.
Don't we automatically
as strong, actually. Sorry?
We know the link, don't we? Because they're in the same small region of a protein.
Well, yes, but nonetheless.
Fair enough. Expect it to be linked, and then the question is there anything more than just neutral substitutions of linked sites?
But this is what we're going to come to, if there's something more than neutral. So, this is not terribly surprising. However, it is against the majority of literature in this case, because people say, well, there is this clustering of fixation events, so selection itself is punctuated. So there's periods of neutrality and stasis, and then there is a boost of selection in given years. Now, in a linked context, this is not at all clear, right? So here, selection could be perfectly homogeneous in time, and linkage alone would produce this clustering of fixation events. So it is the only thing I want to say here is that this linkage, which is indeed not surprising for that one segment, for that contiguous segment, is clearly visible in the genomic pattern.
It's happening at a time scale of 3 or 5 years. So when are these periods of...
I don't want to defend that too much, but what people are saying is, well, look, this is a nearly neutral period, so not much is happening, and then suddenly the antigenic characteristics, for example, change. So there must have been a lot of selection going on in that year. And indeed, the comment I made is that under a strongly linked context, this is you don't have to assume that perfectly. We know that perfectly time-independent selection with linkage alone would give you that pattern. So, there is. Besides linkage, the system has really an outrageously high mutation rate. So if you count the synonymous substitutions on the tree, it's of the order of 5 times 10 to the minus 3 per base pair per year. So that is roughly a factor 10 to the 5 higher than, for example, in Drosophila. And that means that these 40 years are... covering, as I said, about 20 million years of Drosophila evolution. So we're talking really about a macroevolutionary time span. Macroevolutionary also in the sense that the time of observation is longer than the typical fixation time of polymorphism, which is of order 3 years. So we're really seeing here something both on smaller time scales, on microevolutionary time scales, and on macroevolutionary time scales. And we'll have to distinguish these two regimes when we're talking about selection in a moment. But that makes the system really rather unique, that you can go, that you can study these two time regimes in the same system. Yes?
So how about the mutation rate per generation?
Well, then you have to sort of define what a generation is for this system, or whether it's an infection time in a single human host that counts. Or so let me try to not go into this here. But already on a yearly scale, it's pretty high. So one consequence of this is that if you inspect a little bit more in detail the tree and its mutational events, let me go back to it. So if you look at, so the algorithm would tell you that there on individual branches here of this tree, there are mutation events. And if you look in more detail what these mutations are, you find multiple copies of the same mutation on different branches of the tree. So that's quite different from what you would find in a mammalian tree or something like that. So you would, in a given small sample, which is always what these trees are constructed from, every mutation, every at a given biophysical place, so in nucleotide number 273, A to C, that would be unique. You would have clonal interference of different mutations, but here it turns out that you have even sort of a concurrent appearance of the same mutation in competing clones. And that's what I will argue is modifies clonal interference in a strong way. So here is the here is what you see. Here's again our three color-coded classes. And this is the number of originations per allele within one polymorphism. So you see this this mutation A to C in codon number 273 somewhere appearing on the tree, and then that tree, that subtree of the descendants is maybe expanding a bit, so the frequency is non-zero. It might be going to zero again if that trunk is not part of that subtree. And while this clone has a non-zero population size, the same mutation appears somewhere else. So that's what I mean by the same mutation appearing in competing clones. Before that clone has died out, it appears. So we're only talking about overlapping appearances. And then, of course, if you just count the overall allele frequency of that new allele, then you just add the contribution from all of these clones. And then then two things can happen. Either this allele can be lost again, or this allele is fixed in the population, then this polymorphism is over. So we're talking about one polymorphism here, one sojourn through the population, but it's fed by sometimes more than one origination. So this is the diagram of this. So you see here the number of originations per allele. And so again, this is relatively the same for all of three classes, but a fraction of about 40 to 50% of these originations occurs in more than one clone. And this is probably a vast underestimation, this picture, because of those, of course, our sample covers only it's rather fuzzy and the lower end of population frequencies, and probably covers only things that we have reached between 5 or maybe a few percent of the population. Then they become visible in our sample. So at the level of smaller clones, this effect will be even more pronounced. So what does this...
How do you explain the lack of representation of the non-synonymous mutations that are not located in the epitope? It's much less.
No, synonymous, since
the... Non-synonymous, the red ones.
Yeah, because there are much less fixations here. And so this is for fixed polymorphism. So as this is for fixed. You would get, however, a similar picture of this distribution for non-fixed one, and they're simply less because they are, as we'll just see in a moment, under strong negative selection.
Well, and why not the non-synonymous epitope one? I mean, all the green ones here, I guess, they are fixed, and they are the non-synonymous located in the epitope. Why? Because the other ones, they just have been removed, I guess, because of strong purifying selection.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And so why there is this relative population of these three classes, that we're going to come to in a moment. But the point is, despite sort of the overall different normalization factor, had I normalized these three different distributions to one, they would look pretty similar. So that's something that goes throughout all the classes. So what does this do? So we're mentioning this before. This, we should not think of this high mutation rate as just compressing the axis of time. And here's a pictorial representation of what this does. So this is sort of what you would get for classical clonal interference. So you would have a single... So remember, we were looking at these pictures of interfering mutations a few slides ago. But here, we narrow our point of view to a single, say, codon, or a single single nucleotide level. So in a classical pattern, these processes at a single nucleotide level are dominated by a single clone. So this originates somewhere in the population, and if it's a successful polymorphism, I should have made these pictures nicely round like in the previous thing, but I just used triangles. So this is the expansion as a function of time, and then this dashed rectangle denotes the polymorphism time, so the time between origination and fixation. And if you want to map this on a tree, then here in this case, you would have to have an origination event on the trunk of the tree, because this would be in one-to-one correspondence with fixation, if and only if the originations of the trunk, this thing gets fixed. And then as soon as all the other branches have died down, this polymorphism is over. So that would be sort of the basic monoclonal event. And so, but inasmuch as you have several originations, now this picture gets partially randomized. And here is sort of the four processes that can happen at the two clone level. So you could have a clone that is has a first origination here away from the trunk, and then maybe a second origination on the trunk, but the polymorphism, so these would be now the biophysically identical mutation. So, and then as an interval of the polymorphism, you get, if these clones are overlapping, like in this picture is in time, the time interval would be from the first origination until the fixation. So, and on the tree, this would look like this. You would get origination here on some non-trunk branch, and then here a second origination on the trunk, and then once everybody that doesn't have this allele has died out, the polymorphism is over. That would be process one. Process two would be if you get so that would be an advancement. So if you think of this basic clone of this single process as the basic process, so then you would say the origination year has been advanced by this secondary clone here. If this secondary thing happens afterwards, what can happen is the following, is that the fixation of the polymorphism occurs before the fixation of every clone. So the polymorphism was already over here when the sum of these two distinct clones has a population frequency 1. This would not require that any single of them has population frequency 1. And in fact, this is what always would happen if you have recombination, because this would act a little bit like recombination, and that it spreads this new allele in several clones. So in that case, you would have an advancement of the fixation year before the clonal fixation, before any clonal fixation. So that would be this shorter time interval over here. Then what can you do? What else can you have? You can have a secondary third allele, a secondary new allele at the same locus before that polymorphism is fixed. So that would be something like here. It's a different color because it's maybe that the first one is A to C, and this is maybe A to G, and now you have for some period you have the three alleles coexisting. But then, if this is a non-trunk thing, it will just delay the fixation. So process number three is delay of fixation by a secondary clone. And process number four, and this also occurs, is that before that polymorphism is negotiated in the population, a new allele starts, and a third allele starts here. And so in that case, the fixation of the light gray allele would be prevented by a secondary change. So this is what happens if you have a sufficient density of changes at the same locus. Now you can look. We have these time series of allele frequency. We can decompose them by means of the phylogeny into the contribution of different clones, and we can just look what happens. So what do you find? You find plenty of these processes. So originations with this allele, sometimes we get up to 10 originations that are concurrent, but lots of these clones die out quickly, and so this we see a lot. This process number 2 is remarkably absent. There's maybe one case over these 40 years, but that is statistically very rare. So then this delay occurs in the time, and also this prevention of the fixation does occur. So we conclude that there are all these multi-clonal polymorphisms. None of them would be present in a classical picture of clonal interference, but although there are often multiple originations of a change, the fixation remains governed by a single successful clone. So that would, and you can see now if we go back for a moment to this picture, some of these events you can just see that's exactly these deviations from the staircase. And you conspicuously see that there is nothing deviating, nothing above the staircase, except where is this one point? Here is one point above the staircase. But the advancement of the fixation year would produce points left of the staircase, and there are no points left of the staircase. So that is something which should be compared with a model prediction. Pennings and Hermiston have made a model of what should happen at high mutation rate, and they call it soft sweeps. What they are saying is that because a mutation now originates in several clones, there will be these fixations before the clonal fixation, and hence this strong interference picture will be softened. They call it soft sweeps. And the signature of these soft sweeps is that the ancestral variation in the population is partially maintained, because now different ancestors, different clones, contribute to the future. It's no longer one clone that necessarily wins. However, this is not what we see here empirically. Here, there are many starting points of this new allele, several starting points of this new allele, but only one clone wins. And we can discuss why this is the case in a moment.
So can you, now here you have the time series data, right? So can you now, after the fact, go and look at these points that don't fit on the staircase and go and look whether they had multiple origins?
Exactly. So that's what we did. And we counted the number of these cases of these individual processes. This is what we can do. We can, for each of these processes, we can see how often it occurs in the data set. So if I remember, this is in the tens or twenties or thirties, like this thing. This is one event, and this is even more events. So we can, since we have this phylogeny, and we know for each sort of clonal origination process where it started, we can do exactly that.
It seems so those first two should be statistically equally likely, because, you know, in one case it's occurred on the minor branch just a little bit before the major branch, and the other case it's occurred afterwards. So it seems odd that you'd get 20 of one of the other, or whatever you said.
Maybe we defer that discussion until we talk about selection, because we can come back to. I think we have a picture of this, and we can discuss this picture, how likely that is.
What about the population size? It seems to me like you're assuming this is a constant size over time.
Well,
so that it it's really pulsating. In a winter season, you have a lot of spread all over the world, enormous population size, and then it shrinks down again during the summer season. And maybe most of the evolution is actually not going on in this large worldwide population, but in that small population. And that's why you see just a trunk going.
That may be certainly the case. But, you know, here anyway, all these, we take a rather coarse scheme. So we, since this is obviously the part of this thing which is not adequately covered by data yet, and we need more data to follow this pattern, say, within one season in more detail. There have been recent developments and there are recent efforts to get these data. But, you know, here it's really classified only on a yearly basis, so the variations within 1 year don't play a role. And we simply take...
What we have is every time it's maximum during an outbreak, that's when you take the samples.
Well, the samples are collected basically over a whole winter. You know, when a new people collect a lot of these strains in these different WHO centers, and then they do a lot of these HI tests to characterize them antigenically, and when they find that one of these HI tests is not giving enough response with the existing serum, this is actually the it is decided to make a new serum for vaccinations. So the domain, so they are continuously surveyed, and every month or so every couple of months the WHO publishes lists of these strains and which are deemed to be more dangerous and so on. So this is rather a continuous sampling, of course, over the whenever they most occur. So they are probably mostly going to be sampled over the winter. But there are recent efforts to do this in sort of with a more accurate timing of the sampling, and that would of course be relevant to address your point, like what happens within one season. But here it's just classified by 3 years.
Yeah. So forth. I mean, I don't think it's really. Is it really known where the virus is during the off season?
No. I mean, there are.
That was my previous point. That maybe not. It's not even in human. Do we really know that?
Well.
If the actual evolution goes on in that small population, and then these outbreaks, you know, so you have this virus that comes into the. A large population of susceptible humans, and you'll see a lot of stuff going on there perhaps, but it's not important, because the real evolution that goes on is in the small population that feeds every year the large one, and that's why it seems outbreaks and trauma.
Well, I agree with you in so far that obviously the yearly bottlenecks in the non-season are an important feature. This thing. So for what we are going to do in the rest of this talk, we don't need that, because we look what happens from year to year, what mutations have happened, whether they have happened maybe in a preferential subset of the year, maybe off season, maybe mostly in season because the population size has been larger and selection has been stronger. So this is a priori, you can make different hypotheses, but if we do it only year by year, we would not care. But obviously, if these mutations that happen from year to year are maybe concentrated in a given fraction of the year, that's a relevant question. But that's one which is beyond our time resolution for this particular study. But there have been two studies this year that have tried to sort of address this question: where is it off season? Is it somewhere? There's two hypotheses. One is that it's in the tropics. The other that it's sort of in some region in Southeast Asia. And basis, but that's still under debate. So, let me see. This may be a good. This is the last third of the talk, and then if we do it after the coffee break. I guess I hope I convinced you that this thing is strongly linked sequence, and it has this high mutation rate. So in that sense, these two parameters are strong coupling, and they conspire in the sense that the high mutation rate also modifies the clonal interference pattern from what we would get in a classical clonal interference pattern, because now the mutation rate is so high that even at a single locus, things happen during one polymorphism fixation time. So this is another crossover to another behavior. So let's now, in the remaining half an hour, discuss what, if anything, can we say about selection? How can we detect it in this sort of overall strongly linked scenario? So, and this is what I mentioned at the beginning. You would get a lot of naive expectation, at least of ours, were quite wrong. So you could think, well, if we have time series of allele frequencies, then it's rather easy to decide if a change has been positively selected or not. You don't need a lot of population genetics. You just look for the ones that have been quickly fixed, and then you would expect to see shorter fixation times plus more copious numbers of fixations for positively selected changes, because they make it faster through the population. Now, when you plot it, distribution of fixation times, again, there is the overall different normalization between the three sequence classes that comes from the overall number of the difference in the overall number of fixation events. But the shape of these curves looks very similar. So they have a very similar average of, of the order of between 2 and 3 years. So the distribution of fixation times is something that is perfectly the same for all these classes. So you could have maybe be tempted again to say, well, there isn't much selection in this system going wrong, but this couldn't be farther from the truth, as we'll see in a moment. But so this thing is, the message is that clonal interference is, of course, acting to reduce some of the observable differences between the mutation classes. And the same caveat applies to standard population genetic tests. So also, if you were to plot polymorphism spectra, say, for blue and red and green, you also wouldn't see the kind of differences that you would expect from positive and negative selection, simply because at least the high frequency histories or all these trajectories is governed by the same set of selective sweeps. So once you're on the bandwagon of a sweep, you don't really care so much anymore what your own selection coefficient is. So here is an obvious caveat to population genetic inference methods, and the system calls for that we rethink what these tests mean. And so in that sense, the system is, I think, quite interesting as well. So here's what we did. So we looked at directly the allele frequency time series, which we have. We infer them in an approximate way from the tree. And so as a function of time, we have these data. They're not terribly on a terribly fine scale. This is what we just discussed. They're just the time is, we just have them for each year. So they're, the polymorphism starts somewhere, and we can look at it at a given initial time and have an initial allele frequency, and then maybe we decide to look at a later time, and we define the conditional probability of evolving from an initial frequency x initial to a final frequency x final. So this is the kind of observable that we want to study, because this is very well known to physicists. Normally, It would come with an additional label of the time difference between these two points, but here we don't care about the time difference. So this is the appropriate level of coarse graining for this data set. So we don't care about how much time has passed between this initial observation and the final observation, and this gives our conditional probability to go from xi to xf within any interval of time. And then you can do something which is reminiscent of the McDonald-Kreitman test. You take these propagators and you form ratios of these propagators in a given class, so that would be red or green here, with respect to the sort of putatively near-neutral class. And let's call this ratio of propagators phi. And what you can show mathematically, but it's also sort of pretty clear, is that when these propagators become most informative of selection, if we choose as the initial frequency something which is pretty close to zero, so we just count every monomorphism that starts at some low frequency, so the actual starting frequency in our sample is typically of the order of maybe a percent or two, but not much is to be made of of these numbers at this lower end anyway, because there is where our the frequency data become very noisy, because if we know that one out of 18 observed strains had this mutation, well, it's something small, but nothing more. So it is appropriate to take a measure which becomes independent of the entry frequency in the mathematical limit of xi going to zero, and this ratio of propagators does exactly that. And that's one of these sort of nice features which it shares with the McDonald-Kreitman test. Yes? So this takes care of the uncertainty of xi in our data set. So when we do this, then we see we plot this phi of x here in the three classes. So neutral divided by neutral gives, of course, always 1. And then we have here the non-synonymous epitope ones are the green ones, and the non-synonymous non-epitope one are the red line. And so let's concentrate on the red one first in the non-epitope sites. And so the dashed line would be the theoretical value that is, of course, easily computable for independent sites evolving under drift and selection. So this is a moderate negative selection, just to match here sort of roughly the beginning of this. All I want to show with this, I think, what did we take in the end, 6 or 5 or 6? 6. N times S is 6 here. And but what you see is the low frequency part, roughly, of the data curve, which is this here, declines, but then there is a flattening of both classes. And that's, of course, another manifestation of clonal interference. Because once you are at population frequency 0.5, then this is conditional fixed polymorphism, then you are up on the bandwagon and the conditional probability doesn't change any further, and that's exactly what you see here. So this is the selective sweeps that you see here, that the of course, so in under, for independent sites, this would be, this curve would be, it would also reach somewhere 1 here, and the so that's something. So origination, so you can think of this, this is the probability of making it up to frequency x. So the limit of this curve for x equals 1 is just the fixation probability of one of these polymorphisms. And of course, so it's a monotonic function. And here for small frequency, it roughly follows qualitatively that pattern, but then it becomes independent of sequence class, because once you are in sweep, it doesn't the own selection coefficient doesn't matter anymore. So this says that phi is conservative measure of selection. So, and of course, what we look at the end is we look at what this actual phi is at phi of 1. So that is the fixation probability in these classes, and that shows a clear difference between the red and the blue and the green class. So the relative fixation probability is a factor of 2 to 3 higher, and this is here roughly at a level of 0.3 of the neutral fixation probability. So that's the limit of this propagator for the final. This is the final frequency, xf going to 1. So if we just take this fixation, so here the fixation probability is here of order 0.2, 0.3. So 70 or 80% of these sites are under negative selection. But now we have to think, what does this kind of constraint measure mean under this scenario of clonal interference? And that's what you're going to hear much more in the talk by Gergely and Stefan later this week. But let me just sort of make a very qualitative sketch of this. So if we have here a selection called F, and we have a clonal interference scenario, which will S2. So this is the characteristic strength of selective sweeps. Then standard clonal interference tells you roughly all the initial mutations that have a selection coefficient threshold, they are the ones that roughly freely sweep the population. And the door now, what does this interference lead to? And this is what Stefan's and Gergely's talk is, that if you go up to minus sigma tilde, then this is sort of the hitchhiking of mutation of its own. Is of a sufficiently weak magnitude so that it's subject to hitchhiking. And so the substitution probability of these mutations is rendered neutral. So this interval of selection coefficient is sort of acting as if they were neutral under these selective sweeps. And if the selection coefficient is much larger in magnitude than S tilde and negative, then that would be the mutations that have strong enough negative selection to withstand the selective sweeps and still be constrained. So what I would like to argue is that if we measure some kind of constraint for of the order of 80% of under negative selection, this actually says that these are the fraction of sites that are, so I didn't find a good tilde in PowerPoint, so it has become a star here, that are more negative than S tilde. And the one thing that is easy to get in the system is what S tilde is, because this is just what we see as the time interval of typical sweeps. And so that is, if we don't insist of expressing it in generation times, it's just 1/3 years, if we accept years as a scale. So that's very easy, this characteristic time scale. So as an aside, so if we now form the ratio of the mutation rate divided by this characteristic strength of selection, you see that it's of the order of 2%. So that means this is well below the error threshold. So this level of negative selection implied by this analysis is necessary and sufficient to maintain sort of the overall protein structure of this viral protein, because it is sufficiently below the mutation rate. On the other hand, it's not orders of magnitude below the mutation rate. So if the mutation rate were another factor of 100 higher, then this this thing would be in trouble.
I don't see where you get estimating the 1/3 year from. That's
issue. Well, so the one third year is like if we look at the typical fixation times of these successful clones, this is 2 or 3 years. So there's a relatively narrow distribution. So this is what it takes for a typical green allele to start from a few percent to one. So neglecting all sort of logarithmical factors and so on. So
this is neglecting log n. Right?
This is neglecting log n. But I don't know what n means for this system anyway. So I set log n to one. So this is just sort of a very. But we know, you know, we are observing here the polymorphism at an entry frequency of a few percent. So we're really just, and also at the upper end, there is a we don't really know when it's exactly one, right? So whether there is some part of the population the viral population that a small part that carries this. A little bit further, a year further, we don't know. So, given this roughness of the data, that this is sort of inverse.
It's just somewhat useful to remember that this S star then really is a sweep time.
This S star is a sweep time, yes.
So, for example, the mu over S sort of immediately tells us how many mutations your sweeping clone is going to get.
We're going to come to this in a second. So this is now the upper part of the same diagram. For the green guys, you would, if you do the standard McDonald-Friedman type of analysis, you would again take the fixation probability minus 1, and you'd say, well, this is the minimum fraction of this is not sites here, this is wrong. This is substitutions. The fraction of selected substitutions in the green class, that would be of the order of 50%, because you see twice as many substitutions as you would expect under neutrality. And I would apply the same argument that this is now actually giving a more stringent criterion, because if you look at what happens under clonal interference, then all the ones that are below sigma tilde are essentially neutral. So we are counting here effectively the ones that are above sigma tilde, which is the same typical sweep time. Now, if you take this, the absolute number of this is of the order of 40 or 50 mutations. And now you can divide this by the number of sweeps that we see, which is 10. So there is one important conclusion here, which we have to explain, that number of sweeps is significantly lower than the number of driving mutations. So here we see that of the order of 4 or 5 mutations are identified with this test as contributing to one sweep. And so this is, of course, something that we heard before in this program, what this may mean or not mean, but this is just here the empirical observation. So if we do this McDonald-Kreitman type test of the fixation probability, we interpret it as giving us the driving mutations under clonal interference, then their number is by a factor of 4 or 5 higher than the number of sweeps observed. So we can go a little bit further with this frequency analysis, and this is maybe a little bit also an outlook that what more power is in the analysis of time series trajectories. And so here what we do is we want to think about the microevolutionary structure of selection. So remember what we said in the beginning, that we would actually, from this race with the immune system, we would expect that fitness should change on timescales comparable to the times of rising, of rise and fall of clones. Because after all, it's this competition between clones and the competition between clones and the immune system that make this dynamics. So how can we measure that by a population genetics test? Well, to this end, we look at a specific type of conditional probability or propagator, and we call it return propagator, because what we look is, we now look at lost polymorphisms, where the derived allele is lost again. So this starts as an hopeful here, so this would be like sort of primary elections, and then some point this thing converges to zero again. So this kind of trajectory is what we look at. So we look at polymorphisms under the condition that they are lost, and look whether they have exceeded at any time of their travel through the population a threshold frequency XT. And this we plot as a function, or this we look again for very small entry frequency, and so we focus on the behavior of this return propagator as a function of this threshold XT. Why did we choose this observable? Well, the reason is simple, because this observable is, or this kind of trajectory is expected to be very rare under any model of directional selection. So if you take a simple selection coefficient, well, then either sort of this thing is under negative selection, then it would be very hard for it to get to high frequencies. That would be exponentially suppressed. And this would be, this probability would be, so this would be the product of getting, the probability of getting up here and the probability of getting down again. And so this getting up process would be exponentially suppressed under negative selection. And under positive selection, it would be easy to get here with a probability of order 1, but the return part of the trajectory would be exponentially suppressed, because it's, well, if you're positive selected, then you're nearly with probability 1, you make it the rest of the journey, but you don't go down again. So this particular trajectory is, for independent sites, under constant selection, always, except for neutrality, where it's sort of a power, where it's an algebraic curve, is always exponentially suppressed. And you see that here when you make again the ratio of the selected class with respect to the neutral class. So here the red curve and the green curve are always going strongly down, and this is a logarithmic plot. And in fact, they become identical in the limit xi going to zero. So, but now somehow the green curve, my main message has been super weak. So here is a green data curve, and so that means the data do not look at all like any model of negative selection. So the directional selection. Non-synonymous, non-epitope sites are qualitatively behaving the right way. That they're going down, they're going up here again. But this comes with a huge error bar, because at the end there's hardly any points. Positive values of phi for this return propagator are not covered by any model of directional selection. They mean that there's an overrepresentation of high frequencies, well, 0.5, 0.6, something really sort of, what happened here? Something really appreciable in the population, but then it goes down again. And of course, when you think back of the tree, this is just the big chunks of subtrees that are not part of the trunk, but that can become sizable. So with hindsight, of course, this is plainly visible on the tree. And but what does it show? Well, it is perfectly compatible, on the other hand, with epidemiological models that would say that you have a reservoir of immunes for each strain, and that reservoir of immunes is discounted from with each infection. So that's this classical SIR models. So, and for influenza, when you are infected by some strain, you acquire a lifetime immunity against that strain and any sufficiently similar strain. And that means any particular strain can never win against the human immune system, because the more it is successful in 1 year, the larger is this discount from the reservoir of susceptible individuals in the human host population, and the less will be its transmission coefficient in future season, and the less, hence, its fitness. So you would expect, quite generically from these models, that even if a clone is initially successful, there will be a deterministic discount of fitness over its lifetime, and the more successful it was at the beginning, the higher it sort of is the number of early infections in its lifetime, and the steeper is this discount. So you would generically expect that clones that start with a positive fitness will rise in the population and then go down again. So exactly this Red Queen effect is what is compatible with this kind of overrepresentation of intermediate frequencies that would not be possible under any model of simple directional selection. So this means, like, because in a broader context, that these time-dependent observations enable us to probe much more ecology of this system. And here I think we see some feature of this ecology, but of course more can be done. And it says, of course, that we should move away from looking at selection as only sort of coefficient numbers. There is this whole time component to selection, which was, of course, also the main theme of Willem Mustermann's talk. Here we're specifically looking at short time scales, and he was mainly looking at long time scales. So this is my conclusion. So when we look at the system, I think there is three things that are vital ingredients for understanding the observed pattern. There is strong selection giving rise to these sweeps in the first place, and of course there is the strong linkage effects, and the linkage effect together with the high mutation rate generates a new pattern of clonal interference. And let me see, I'm not sure whether this came up in the right. We call this process stochastic clonal interference because of these multi-clone processes and the way they partially randomize the temporal ordering in a strict clonal interference pattern. So we see that sweeps are governed by multiple driving mutations of the order of 4 or 5, but nevertheless they remain strong. So they would not as in a scenario of the same mutation appearing in different clones, and the mutation being fixed in different clones, then you would see these multi-clonal fixations and softer sweeps. But here what we observe is that the sweeps remain strong. At the same time, they are governed by multiple driving mutations. So when you go back to recent models of clonal interference, in particular under high mutation rate, like the model of Desai and Fisher, then multiple driving mutations are predicted to occur when the distribution of selection coefficients of beneficial mutation is sufficiently steep, so that the differences in selection coefficient for typical beneficial mutations become small. However, this assumes that these mutations are drawn independently from some distribution. This assumption, of course, is broken when the identical mutation is playing a role in different clones, because then we can hardly assume them to be independent draws from that distribution. So what it appears to be here is once the identical mutation is drawn, that multiple driving mutations become more generic. Because the scenario here is that one beneficial change is occurring in more than one competing clone, and at the same time, one clone contains more than one beneficial mutation at a time. But nonetheless, one of these combinations is going to be the best one. Even if you don't assume any epistasis, then the fitness of each clone would be the sum of its own basket of beneficial mutations. And that race is going to be decided somehow. If two clones have the same, say, best mutations, well, then they will differ by the second best mutation. If they also have the same doublet, then the race is going to be decided at the level of the next best mutation. So inasmuch as we talk about these identical mutations, the combinatorical game changes, and sweeps remain strong. There is always going to be one best clone, whether that clone is decided at the level of a single mutation or at the level, say, of a triplet. This is another story. So there is one best clone, but at the same time, if several clones share the same best mutations, well, then the fate at the end is decided by the level at which clones become unique, be that doublets, triplets, or quadruplets of mutations. Yes?
So what is the important consequence of having multiple driving mutations then? So suppose I was a lazy person, I didn't want to worry about that. What would I get wrong?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe, so the point I think that is not addressed by this study, and this is what future maybe more detailed simulation studies will have to look at, is whether they just add up in their fitness effects or whether it's epistatic. And because it could be that you need, say, for example, suppose there were a rule that you need two or three mutations to modify your binding pocket in a way. In that case, it would be, you would...
another issue, right? It's not...
This is another issue, yes.
Having these recurrent mutations.
Right.
Yeah, but if you just had epistasis, and then you can talk about, the wind clone is the one that has whether you have to go down from the third or fourth advantageous mutation, it seems to me, could produce a relatively smooth process of kind of clonal substitution. As opposed to like the original data you show and the point of coming to the fact that there's multiple substitution, that those events are fairly well spaced in time. There's not a smooth process, is there, of these substitutions? There's a kind of a clonal type.
Yeah, I mean, they are clustered. They are not entirely clustered. It's at 70-80%, so there are substitutions between these big events, but the majority, so it is, I would argue it is a clear clonal interference pattern, but and it is this inference predicts that there is more than one beneficial mutation per successful clone, but it's sort of different from all the models that people looked at before, because since, say, the best beneficial mutation comes in different clones with different backgrounds, namely with different pairs of other mutations, it's not so that it's a soft scenario that these clones rise simultaneously. It's always one that wins. So that, unlike in the soft sweep scenario, the race between clones has a clear winner. On the other hand, I don't think in this system you require any particular assumption on the distribution of selection effect for beneficial mutations to get this multiplicity of driving mutations, because you have another effect. You have the biophysical identity of mutations, so you just draw different combinations from a set of beneficial mutations, and then it's just the other side of this medal, that then this race is going to be decided at maybe the level of triplets. That depends on mu, and how copious these beneficial mutations are.
I still don't see how it leads to this kind of major event-like shift you see in the data.
Well, I think that...
Maybe that has more to do with the host, or just enhancing some threshold where you need a major antigen.
Maybe. I mean,
I don't know. But
there could be, in addition, epistasis. So it could be, so for example, there's this triplet of mutations that happens to coincide in one clone that then happens to be the best, is good because they work together.
Well, I'm thinking not only that they work together, but that the order in which those things come in may also matter.
It may also matter. There is some indications for that. So when you look at, this has been noticed in the paper from Lee's group last year, you sometimes see like initial mutations lingering around for a while, and then another one comes, and then they take off together. Of course, all this gets a big question mark when you look at, when you take into account seriously clonal interference, because then you would also expect this kind of pattern without any assumptions on epistatic selection. So I think epistatic selection, although it has been very sort of a conclusion in several papers, in view of this linkage, has to be put with a question mark. But it could be one thing that makes a particularly strong sweeps.
And so they didn't look at the rate of substitution compared to synonymous sites.
No. In fact, they argue that there is little hitchhiking, and we find the contrary here.
Right. So speaking of linkage, so you didn't talk much about recombination. So what happened to recombination? So were we just assuming that things are so close together that there are no recombination events occurring? And,
well,
should we be worrying about that?
So we just discussed this is in Richard over the break, and it's over these 40 years, these sequences are perfectly gaplessly alignable. So, however, of course, at small frequencies, what happens, whether sort of recombination is really biophysically not taking place, or in most cases simply rejected by strong selection, that's maybe hard to tell. And so it is known empirically that there's very frequent reassortment between these genomic fragments. People have started to look at this in very much detail. There are maps of how these segments recombine. And that's in fact one of the major sort of generators of virulence, that you get these recombinations. And so that's something which also has been neglected here, which should be done to add the rest of the genome to this analysis, because clearly for fitness, this is maybe one important part, but it has to be only part of the story. So making initial contact with the antibodies is not the whole story of the virus life cycle. So that is something that has been just because it's probably... So you can see that it is a major part of the virus fitness, because the antigenic data, the phenotypic data that of course integrate everything, are in good correspondence with these fixation clusters in the HA domain. So it is probably the main part. But for example, in answering this question, what really makes the sweeps, would probably be good to look further. So empirically, this is what people know at the moment, that there is this frequent reassortment between these segments, but not much is known.
So the notion is that there are hotspots which account for the reassortments, but you happen to be looking inside the block, which isn't recombinant.
They are independent sequences, so they're not linked.
So are they more variable? Are the other so we need to work on five marks in the other segments? Are the other segments much more?
I mean
much more polymorphic than the HA which you've been talking about.
There are not so many sequences available, and so I don't know. We have not looked at them.
So basically, the HA is the most variable, and then that's followed by the other surface protein, which is the neuraminidase, and then the internal genes are pretty highly conserved.
In a population sample?
Yes, over 40 years.
So the overall...
Well, I'm not talking about the 40 years, because...
No, but within a population, there's very little observed.
By selection, those are going to change a lot, but just how much variation there is.
Very little.
Very little.
I see. Okay. I think I'm like...
Sorry, maybe I miss a point, but when you are saying that you are in spiders like kind of multiple reassortment or recombination-like episodes, but in your graphs, it seems, I mean, you are assuming almost absence of recombination, but then still you see a huge difference between your synonymous evolutionary rate versus the other ones, and should not be independent somehow, at least partially.
Well, I think we see a pattern if we look at the, let's look again, at the, the differences in the frequency propagator between the classes. So they build up for small frequency, but they flatten out at higher frequency, and I think that is exactly the consequence of this linkage effect. So that once you have reached a certain frequency, then the further probability of going up or down is determined by the sweep. So there is differences between these classes build up at small frequencies and then are carried over by the rest, by these sweeps. At least that's the kind of interpretation that we have of this. Okay, so just to wrap this up, selection itself is dynamic. It's probably dynamic on both macroevolutionary timescales, generating sort of this recurrent new windows of positive selection. That's the kind of scenario that Ville Mustonen has talked about. But here, it's also very dynamic on small time scales, and part of this may be traceable from genomic data. And the next to last point I want to make is that we've seen that all these tests of population genetics come with a question mark here. And that's exactly this kind of question that we have discussed, for example, last week in a broader context throughout the workshop. And I think they can all be asked for this system. And so how to infer selection, what, for example, population science means, is something that the system very much, a question that the system poses. And since we have these observations on different timescales, may offer some clues to answering them. And so I think the system should become a model organism. Simply the sequencing that has been done so far has not been done, has been done sort of for biomedical reasons by WHO, but we don't have a really good random sample of the population. People have not taken so much care where their samples come from. In Drosophila, we know we go to Africa and try maybe go there to get sort of rid of regional adaptation processes and so on. That kind of consideration is also part of the difficulties that pop up in this data analysis that we have already discussed. So, and finally, so the question is the system predictable? And I think that's an open question. But it has so far not been predicted. But first of all, before we answer the question, we should define exactly what we mean by predictability. So nobody can predict the elephant. So nobody can predict with near certainty, nobody can predict like what will be future beneficial mutations of the system and their effect. Maybe in some cases you could have a guess of if this binding pocket were to mutate from A to C at that particular position, then you would expect something great to happen. But probably not. So, and then you would not be able to predict whether this is a stochastic process. But the part that may be predictable is exactly the deterministic part. So exactly this selection part that we've been focused in our talk. So the question is a little bit, is this deterministic part of the evolution, what is the time scale on which it's randomized by all the other stochastic forces? And is this, so if we ask the most modest question that we could ask on predictability, namely, can we predict, like, given us knowledge of the strains in March at the end of one winter, can we predict it sufficiently enough so that we know what we should put in the vaccine in September? So that's a fairly limited period of time. And so we could predict what the repertoire that we see in this year, what clues that may offer us for the future. So that's a rather limited time span. And on that time span, the question is not obviously no. And we've seen that we can see these deterministic effects rather clearly at the level of mutation classes. Now, these classes are not terribly big. So we're talking about here in the epitome about 64 codons. If it were possible to sort of using, the obvious next step would be to integrate HI data in this analysis. If it were possible to disentangle the selection effects up to the single mutation from the maybe 5 or 6 mutations that are going on every year, then one should be able to say within the existing strains in a given March, what would be the one that has the best cards to reappear strong next September. So that, with a judicious population genetic analysis and sort of maybe more copious HI data, does not seem to be completely out of the question. So maybe it's a little bit a question how much epistasis is there. Because you could think, well, if really everything is only decided at the level of combinations, then it's probably very hard to predict. Because every combination occurs for the first time. However, if epistasis is limited, maybe there could be microevolutionary predictability. So that's the kind of question that we may ask and we may have a chance to answer in the coming years. Thanks a lot.
So coming back to that epistasis, do you find any evidence for like coordinated substitutions? The particular sites in the genome that sort of pick up simultaneous substitutions at various places in the tree?
Well, there are there are such sites, but the analysis is is probably statistically difficult, because there are some sites that pop up in different contexts, but there are also hypermutable sites. So there are some sites that do something all the time.
But are they hypermutable because of the sequence or because of the protein function? Because so mutations there are much more likely to convey some kind of benefit.
We don't know, it could very well be that these sites that mutate all over the place have relatively little to do.
So either sites or regions. So for example,
Individual codons. So there are some codons that are just outrageously swapping back and forth without any sort of discernible sense.
So outrageously means that more than some others.
Yeah. And so that analysis of the correlations is probably difficult at the level of substitutions, because for that, you know, you can see here over the in the epitope, the non-synonymous epitope substitutions over these 40 years is of the order of 80.
And so you've got 60 sites.
Yeah, and so it's good enough to do single particle statistics. And you compare them, for example, with the 50 that were expected under neutrality, or if they were synonymous, then you can say that's a reasonable overrepresentation. You can conclude that there's positive selection. There's simply not enough to answer your question. There are strong heterogeneities in
within. Which reduces your effective number of sites you want to look for, so it kind of makes the problem a little bit easier, probably not easy enough to
hopefully
get anywhere.
Yes.
So you use this return propagator as evidence for this red queen type of selection. There was too many things that got to a high frequency and then died out. So does that take into account, so I might think that clonal interference would produce exactly that kind of signal. So if I have two clones with slightly different selective advantages arise at once, they're both going to increase in the population, then one's going to win. And so one of them will deterministically have this up and then down trajectory.
Part of this effect is clonal interference, but then in addition there's the overrepresentation of this effect in the non-synonymous epitope codons. And that, I think, this overrepresentation effect is again a difference between selection classes that I would have a bit more difficulty to explain by merely clonal interference. So that's what we take as the main evidence for
the immune landscape is constantly changing, and it's just things that are more successful initially.
Exactly. So that's exactly because the effect is not homogeneous over the selection classes.
So that's the evidence that makes it even stronger, because the other, like, not synonymous sites didn't show this at all.
Well, if you, I showed you the in the plot, I showed you the ratio of these propagators. What I showed you was something like here's one for synonymous, and then it had a curve like this. This was the invisible curve of mine.
Yeah, and that was for non-synonymous.
Now, if you plot the probability itself, not the ratio, it looks a bit like this. So of course, it has to go to zero at one. It starts always from one. At 0 and 0 at 1, and then you would, if you normalize it, you would get sort of something which is bigger here. So here you would get more in the selected class. So probably this part here is merely exactly that what you, can you see it? Or is it hidden from you? This part is nearly what you were mentioning. If part of this effect is produced by selective sweep, but then the overrepresentation in the green class is maybe sort of at least consistent with the time dependence, the microevolution and time dependence of selection.
One more question. Are there, some other people know the answer. You know, if you argue that this should be a model system, we can learn population genetics from this, which I agree. Are there other good, like, viral or bacterial disease systems where one should also try to, within the gaining agency to also build the same kind of time to get population trajectories, start building them? Because they say like this one, well, okay, we're going to have to wait another 60 or 80 years to double the long-term. But perhaps there's 10 different systems we could build, because it's so trivial to do now.
I mean, right,
it's
right.
Truly trivial. And to launch a much larger scale effort to simultaneously track many systems.
Right.
I don't know which ones would be good candidates.
That's a good point. I'm not too nasty. I mean, for example, HIV is we were going to hear about.
HIV is obviously
it's obviously very different.
And different.
So it's it does not have this sort of narrow tree, and so the selection is acting differently on it. But it would be probably. I'm not able to answer the question at the moment, but there should be systems which are roughly which have the same overall characteristics, and that would make sense to put in a joint analysis.
Actually, maybe I can answer part here. So HIV on the population level is very different from what you described here, but if you follow one infected individual over time, it looks fairly similar. Not quite like this, but fairly similar to what influenza does on the whole world. But I think my answer would be that if you looked in 10 different virus systems, they would all be very different because the biology is so different.
Yeah, but you learn from that.
I agree with that, and I think it would be more interesting to look into very different systems than trying to find everything that's similar to one of the systems.
Well, I think pathogens like dengue, for example, would be an excellent complementary system to look at in addition to HIV and influenza. I mean, it has four different subtypes and a nearly global distribution, and would have very different ecological and evolutionary dynamics. But therein would be a useful model system for comparing it to things like HIV and influenza.
Yeah, I think dengue people have looked at, if I remember correctly.
What's that?
I think dengue people have looked at, if I remember correctly. There is some work on this.
But it's something where the infrastructure as compared to influenza and HIV, for example, is infinitely small.
Yeah.
And is ripe for both public health and public good, but also an incredible wealth of data.